now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, this is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Hugh Wozencroft, and while football continues to throw up plenty for us to discuss, today Rangers win their first Scottish title in a decade in style. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's dominance over Pep Guardiola keeps astounding. Fulham have given themselves a huge lifeline at the bottom of the Premier League as well. We will ask, do you really need to change the offside rule? And what is your club's ultimate run? To help me through all of that today, Matt Dickinson, Tom Clark and Gregor Robertson. Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Very well, Hugh. Thank you. Little bit jaded. I worked across the weekend and ended up watching 9 matches in total from Friday night through to Sunday. So, yeah, whether that'll translate into good analysis on this podcast, we'll wait and see. But I definitely covered all the bases. I started with Huddersfield against Cardiff on Friday night, which was not the most entertaining of all the games. 0-0. Mm. Did anyone know Yaya Sanogo, formerly of Arsenal, is now at Huddersfield?
I did. The bigger man himself.
He missed a penalty. Poor bugger. He missed a penalty.
And did Lincoln get back to winning ways?
They did. They beat Crew 3-0. Very good performance. So, yeah.
Back on track. Good to hear. Maybe not a title win just yet for Lincoln. You never know by the end of the season. One thing that is already certain, though, up in Scotland, it's an incredible title win for Rangers. They lifted the Scottish Premiership for the first time in 10 years. Celtic failed to beat Dundee United, which sealed the inevitable, frankly. It is a first title as a manager for the former Liverpool and England captain, Steven Gerrard. And let's begin today's game podcast with our Scottish football correspondent, Michael Grant. I started by asking him, just how remarkable is this title win, given the last decade or so at Ibrox?
It's a fairly epic story and storyline, Hugh. It was always going to be an enormous season for Rangers because of the kind of determination to stop Celtic reaching 10 in a row. But I think what we've seen over the last 24, 48 hours has been the prevailing narrative of Rangers' recovery and emergence from what's been a pretty wretched decade for them. No major trophies since 2011. Financial implosion starting again in the fourth tier of Scottish football. And that long journey up with a few stumbles along the way. And they always referred to it, their fans always referred to it as the journey right from the start. And that implied, not just existing in the lower leagues in Scottish football, but making it back. And to them, making it back wasn't promotion to the top flight again, which came in 2016. It was being the champions of Scotland again. And they have finally made it under Steven Gerrard. So there's various strands to this. You know, there's the Rangers' re-emergence over the last decade. There's the stopping 10 in a row, which might not sound like a big deal outside Scotland, but within the Old Firm rivalry, it's huge. And then there's the addition of Steven Gerrard as the leader and the icon that's taken them across the finishing line.
You've written a feature on everything that's happened under Steven Gerrard at Rangers in The Times right now. Where does this season rank amongst their best title wins, though? 28 victories, 4 draws, no defeats as yet.
The numbers are remarkable. They really are. I mean, I don't think Rangers supporters, certainly the older ones, would rank this as one of the truly great Rangers sides in terms of the individual players. Even Steven Gerrard himself told us last week that he regarded the team as the superstar rather than it having superstars within it. So you know, you take that caveat, but I think in terms of the efficiency and the relentlessness of the team, it's beyond dispute and beyond criticism. They are on course to be the first Rangers team to go through a top flight season unbeaten since 1899. Now that they've won it, we've seen it in various leagues that teams sometimes drop off when they win a league early, and they might actually be more vulnerable now that they've won it. But the number of victories, the few number of drop points, the number of clean sheets are all really off the scale. They're 20 points clear of Celtic. I think that's more likely to widen rather than narrow in the remaining five matches. And they've just not let up from day one. They've been relentless, and they've not given Celtic or anybody else a sniff of hope, really.
And it's not just the way they've cast Celtic aside this season, really. Also, their performances in the Europa League has shown us that Steven Gerrard could be building something pretty special. Do you think there could be a period of Rangers dominance in Scotland to come now?
I'm not sure, Hugh, to be honest with you. I think there's always a tendency when one club changes the balance of power and tips the scale their way that we automatically assume that you're now entering a period of domination from them. Much will depend on how Celtic respond over the summer, the quality of personnel that they bring in, both in terms of the manager, the director of football, and signings are going to need our after new signings. But what Rangers have is stability. I don't think Steven Gerrard is going to leave anytime soon. Clearly, Liverpool are wobbling, and when Jurgen Klopp leaves, I think a lot of people will assume that Gerrard might be the guy that they turn to. I think when they do come for him, he'll go. I don't think you would gamble on getting a second chance further down the line. But that's not going to come this summer, I'm convinced of that. So he will have another go, at least one more go. He'll go for the Champions League and see where his team can get to in that. Can they make an impression at the elite level in Europe rather than just the Europa League? So a period of nomination, I'm not sure, but one thing that I do find significant is I don't think there's a single individual player that Rangers would lose that would completely unsettle the team. They're such a strong side. They've got interchangeable deputies in pretty much every position. So when they have to start selling, and the club have been open about that they will have to start selling players to start balancing the books, I'm not sure that's going to be particularly ruinous to the team.
I think I agree with you on that one. Steven Gerrard himself says this team still has more to go. This is pretty much only the beginning for him. And it's massive for Scottish football as well, that I think if Celtic can be stronger next season, that they have those real two figureheads in Scottish football back where they are, big for the product of the Scottish Premiership as well. And just finally, Michael, what is the view in Scotland this morning about the fans, thousands of them, gathering near Ibrox and in Glasgow's George Square as well?
Well, that depends on who you support. I mean, if you're a Rangers fan, you think it's entirely understandable and permissible. If you support anybody else, then it's the greatest scandal and outrage that you've seen. I think it's significant that politically there's been a lot of condemnation of it. The First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, called it disgraceful and infuriating. I think we've seen this, haven't we, in football in general. You saw it at the end of last season with Leeds fans gathering, Liverpool fans gathering, even up here last week on a much lower level, St Johnstone fans gathered after they won the League Cup. So I think there's an element within football that just goes to hell with it. This is too big a moment for us not to come out. The numbers were big in Glasgow, there's no question about it, and around Ibrox on Saturday, again yesterday, in George Square in Glasgow, and it's not a good look. There's no getting away from it. It's not a good look to see, you know, a couple of thousand fans in close proximity, no social distancing, a lot of them not wearing masks, just acting like normal, really, you know, as if there wasn't a pandemic going on. It's not a good look, Hugh.
Michael Grant, thank you so much, and you can read what Michael's had to say in the Times right now. Make sure you subscribe for all of that, a long read on all that Rangers have achieved and Steven Gerrard's management as well. Gregor Robertson, massive applause required for the effort of these Rangers players.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been Gerrard's kind of stature and presence and aura has not only been good for Rangers, but for Scottish football. And I, you know, obviously I've said before, I'm a Celtic fan. But undoubtedly, his arrival in Scottish football is a good thing. And it's just a remarkable achievement. I think when you look at the state of Rangers when he arrived, and who was the manager of Celtic at the time, Brendan Rodgers, and how dominant they were, I don't think anyone really gave him much of a chance, to be brutally honest, of halting 10 in a row, which Scottish football is, and particularly Old Firm, has been consumed by for a decade. And he's done it. And it's an extraordinary achievement. And, you know, as Michael was alluding to, not only that, his achievements in Europe. That's the kind of thing that would make other clubs sit up and notice, I think, because no matter what we say or what people who watch Scottish football a lot say, it's still kind of looked down upon a little bit. But when I think he's won 23 European fixtures, which is five short of Walter Smith's time. That's astonishing. And again, some big clubs, some good teams. So, you know, Rangers have an identity now as well. They're real industrious, organised. They kind of mirror Steven Gerrard a little bit. So absolutely, I have no problem in saying that I have some problem in saying it, but he deserves great credit. And I very much hope he sticks around as well, personally, because, as I say, his presence in Scottish football is a good thing for Scottish football. And when you look at, you know, obviously he's going to be linked to Liverpool between now and the moment he arrives at Liverpool. Who knows when that's going to be. But really, I can't see where he's better off going, where he's better off being. He can do something pretty special with them in terms of getting into the Champions League, hopefully for Rangers fans, and, you know, testing himself against even bigger and better opponents.
Yeah, I think after their last win in the Europa League, actually, Gerrard now equal with Walter Smith in terms of European wins. Of course, Walter Smith's came in the Champions League, the vast majority of them, and afterwards Gerrard said, you know, you can't talk about me alongside such a great manager. But Matt, I think he's got the potential to do so. Great things, maybe a period of dominance coming for Rangers, and maybe a future Liverpool and England manager in Steven Gerrard. What do you think?
Well, I guess it is the curse for sort of Scottish football that as soon as anyone does well, then the next thing we ask is when they're coming down to England. I mean, it's been that way for a while, and that is going to now happen with Steven Gerrard. You know, I think I agree with everything that Greg has said. It's, you know, I think crucially he's been there long enough that people have seen that he has a clarity of style about what he wants from his players. I think that's a big thing. I think that's one of the questions that maybe, you know, Frank Lampard has struggled with. You know, Gerrard and Lampard inseparable still, even in this argument. But I think, you know, sort of Frank suffered for options and clarity, you know, in that time at Chelsea, almost a surfeit of options. And I think if you're appointing an up-and-coming young coach, you would want to know that he has a sort of, say, clarity of thought about what he wants from a team, how he wants to build it. And I think a crucial thing that people say about Gerrard is that he surrounded himself with good coaches to help him do that. You know, Gary McAllister on the sort of slightly wiser, older head, but Michael Beale gets a lot of rave reviews as a first team coach, who is someone who, you know, very smart, started off through youth footballs, got South American experience, but, you know, someone who is trusted to sort of put the plans into practice on the training ground. And I think that ability to sort of surround yourself with good people is another key asset if you're going to build a sort of long-term strong management career.
I think it's going to be a strong one for Steven Gerrard to continue what he's done already. A great run in the Europa League. Fantastic title for them. Once again, my thanks to Michael Grant for helping us discuss it. And I'm sure we'll be discussing Rangers again before the end of the season, because they are an outside tip, as far as I'm concerned, for that Europa League. And we might not have to wait that long to see Steven Gerrard. Who knows, in the Anfield dugout either, because it's now six straight home defeats for Jurgen Klopp. His side dropped to eighth. But I think it's Fulham who we've got to talk about most here. They impressed once again. Their survival hopes, well, they're right back in it. Newcastle 16th on 27 points, then it's Brighton 17th, a point behind them, the same number of points as Fulham, even though Newcastle and Brighton have a game in hand. Tom Clark, it was another fantastic performance from Scott Parker's side.
It certainly was. It was, of all those games that I watched at the weekend, theirs was arguably the most impressive. Liverpool have obviously lost quite a number of games at home this season now. And this wasn't quite the same as some of those where they just looked turgid and completely devoid of ideas. Liverpool weren't bad, I didn't think, but Fulham were fantastic. Areola in goal was superb, but Tosin Adarabayo in defence was superb. He's been, you know, great for them this season, slowly improving, finally showing all the potential that he's had. Harrison Reed continues to impress me in midfield. He was good in the Championship last season, and he's kind of, I'd say, emblematic of what Scott Parker's tried to do. You know, he's not changed lots. He's tweaked little things here and there. He's changed the tactics, but we've talked about it before with Fulham, where the last time they were in the Premier League, they chopped and changed so much. They spent so much money. Whereas this time, they clearly had an idea and a way of they wanted to play. They wanted to stick by Scott Parker. If you go back in the season, I think in December, they lost to Manchester City and they only had 7 points in December. You know, so in previous Premier Leagues and with other teams, there could have been calls to change the manager, sack the manager, bring in someone else. Obviously, we saw that with West Brom. But they've shown that faith in him and they're starting to see the rewards because they were absolutely brilliant. I think Lamina's goal summed up their performance as well. On the front foot, you know, when Mo Salah gets the ball on the edge of his own penalty area, not every opposition player would steam in, try and steal it from him, take a touch and then shoot. You know, you'd maybe jockey him, maybe stop him from turning, maybe stop the counter-attack, maybe even do a little foul. But he steamed in there, nicked the ball, and fired it into the bottom corner. And I think they kept doing that all game. They were on the front foot, pressing. They were superb.
Matt, do you think Scott Parker can make a late charge for Manager of the Year?
I don't know about that, but I think you're certainly, you know, he's getting, rightly, getting an awful lot of praise and, you know, should do, to be honest, even if they end up getting relegated by, you know, the odd result here or there, which is still obviously possible. But I think the fact, the way he's stabilised the team, I think, you know, we talked about this a week or two ago about, you know, he's had to rebuild the team on the hoof, to be honest, to some extent. You know, they brought in, it's a sort of completely different back line from how they started the season. They've had to, you know, they've brought in some better players, but, you know, he's also had to sort of coach that and adjust that. He's had to deal with the sort of the confidence being smashed in those first couple of months of the season. So, you know, he's shown resources as a motivator too, as a tactician, and just as a calm, steady influence. So I think, you know, Scott Parker's stock has risen whatever happens over the next the rest of the season.
Gregor, I know you don't like predictions, but at this point, how do you see that relegation fight going?
Well, look, Fulham, the thing, they've had 6 clean sheets in the last 7 games. It's just a remarkable turnaround. And for a team that's fighting at the bottom of the league, that's going to make all the difference, really. Particularly when you look around at, you know, Newcastle having half their forward line injured and being in a bit of state of turmoil. West Brom have kind of solidified things, but they just keep missing sitters. they can't put the ball in the back of the net. You know, Deani's been a real big focal point for them, and he's performed well and he's had good chances and he's getting the right areas. He just can't apply the final touch. So undoubtedly Fulham, you know, everyone talks about momentum and they have it just now, and they look, as I say, they looked really, really well, I've said this before, they're really well coached, really solid. The way that they've evolved this season from last season being so dominant in possession and almost kind of to the point of boredom for some of their fans too. Like, they want a bit more dynamism and forward thinking. And I don't think they came into the league expected to play that way, but I think they've kind of found that Parker's kind of navigated his way towards a way of playing that will get them results. And part of that has been, as Dicko says, kind of transforming the team. They've only got a couple of players in the team that were in the Championship last season. And yeah, I think they're looking like they've got a really good chance. As Dicko says, even if, I did a piece a few weeks ago looking at, you know, the fine margins at play at the bottom of the league are remarkable. And even if Fulham were to go down, they've got someone in at the helm there, in Scott Parker, who is really, really promising. And they look like they've learned their ways in terms of the recruitment. And Fulham look like a club that have kind of got a bit of a plan now, and I think that probably will keep them up. But even if it doesn't, that still bodes well for the future for them.
Tough games coming up for Fulham against Manchester City and Leeds. They've still got Villa, Arsenal, Chelsea and Manchester United to play. Fulham against Newcastle on the final day of the season, Tom. Will it come down to it?
It could well do. I mean, only one podcast ago, I think I said Newcastle would just about survive. Having watched them against West Brom, I'm now ready to change my opinion because I thought West Brom were the better team in that match as well. Apart from the odd little moment from Willock in midfield for Newcastle, they looked pretty uninspired. It could well come down to that. But with the way Fulham are going, as Gregor says, with momentum and things, you wouldn't be surprised if they picked up a few points against in games where you wouldn't expect them to. I'm not saying they'll necessarily go and beat Manchester City, but I wouldn't be surprised if they went into that final game ahead of Newcastle on points with the way things are going.
They've just had clean sheets against Liverpool and Spurs.
Yeah, like
they are a tough proposition just now to break down. I think Anderson as well, someone who deserves a big mention. He's been, both of those centre halves have transformed them in terms of, you know, organising players around them, just looking really resolute. That clearance in the last minute. Yeah, the cross, I think it was Andy Anderson's cross, and he's kind of looked like a shoo-in for Mane. That was like a goal. It was remarkable. He's been outstanding for them.
Brilliant. I love Scott Parker, and I keep thinking about this Celtic job. You know, you look at the squad that Fulham have at the moment, you think, what could he do? You know, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what the future holds for him.
His stock has been strange. Last season, I said this before, he's kind of, although they were promoted, until he was standing on the turf at Wembley and it was done, there were still question marks about him, even from within, you know, from their own fans, kind of about his future at Fulham. And they expected to win the league, basically. And his stock has risen more this season, even before this run. His stock has risen more this season because he seems like as we're saying, you can see the plan and he's coaching and the evidence of that on the field. And he's also an engaging presence in front of the cameras, and that's important these days.
And if we're giving Scott Parker the full loving, is actually, someone told me a story last week, actually. I probably shouldn't go into too much detail, but let's just say it was someone who was struggling in life a bit, struggling with mental health a bit, and it was Scott Parker came across him and, let's just say, intervened and gave this person more than a shoulder to cry on, gave him some sort of real life advice, opened up himself, and I just came away thinking, wow, you know, Scott Parker sounds a very nice human being. So I just sort of throw that in. I only heard it last week. And he's more than an impressive coach from that account.
So what you're saying is, with your QPR hat on, you're desperate for Fulham to stay in the Premier League. That's what you're saying, right?
Now we're pushing it. He might be a nice bloke, but no, that's going too far. It would be... it would be nice to have a few London derbies. Obviously, if Brentford want to stay down in the Championship, then feel free.
We'll see what Thomas Frank does with the rest of their season as well. Lots still to look forward to on the game podcast. We're going to talk about the offside law next. But remember, if you do enjoy the podcast, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast from. Make sure you're subscribed as well so you don't miss the next episode or any of our award-winning journalism. You can get a subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times and get 1 month free if you sign up today. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get started.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's talk about VAR, baby. Specifically, offside. What, Tom? What? What's wrong with that?
No, I just, to be honest, I need that kind of enthusiasm if we're going to talk about VAR, so I'm all for it. I'm laughing along with you, Hugh, don't worry.
I had to go in hard.
Don't mention the VAR. Not again.
I can tell there's going to be varying opinions on this. Let's talk about offside. I will allow contributions on handball as well on this. You think back to Chelsea's Timo Werner. He was narrowly ruled offside for a disallowed goal against Liverpool last week. Harry Kane's goal versus Palace stood, the flag stayed down, but VAR helped us clear it up. But it was another narrow incident of the lines being drawn, just went the other way. And now we hear that FIFA are prepared to trial a new offside rule presented by none other than their chief of global football development, the former Arsenal boss Arsene Wenger, who thinks onside should be if any goal-scoring part of the body is in line with the last defender. Does it fundamentally, from a defender's point of view, change the sport? And if so, is it for better or worse?
I mean, there's a pretty big risk of that being true, yes. It's, you know, surely, I can't see how defenders won't have to drop deeper. And is that a good thing for the game? I don't know. It's very hard to... It also just looks like they're moving the line, so you're going to be... Yes, you won't anymore get a goal that we think should have been a goal chalked out because of, you know, a shoulder or an armpit. But the line of measurement will still exist, and instead we'll see goals that stand that for 30 years we think shouldn't have stood. So, you know, it's a pretty big shift from one very unsatisfactory set of circumstances to what I think will be another pretty unsatisfactory set of circumstances. So, look, they're trialing. I'll be interested. Trialing in China, I believe. I'll be interested to see how that works out. But I can't also, from a defender's point of view, as I say, I can't see how you don't have to. You're not going to have to just drop deeper. And I don't think that's necessarily a good thing for the sport.
Matt, I think Greg is right. We're still going to need VAR. The lines are still going to be drawn. There are still going to be marginal calls. This doesn't change anything, does it?
Well, I think it doesn't change the fact that people are going to row about it, because that's what we do, isn't it? You know, no one need be worried about the lack of screaming and shouting at officials. That will continue forever. But I do see the point of this trial, because I think we have seen one of the side effects of VAR is that we've seen goals chalked off that we think, you know, in our sporting souls should be goals. And, you know, whether it's armpits or toenails or whatever, I think we look at goals and just think, well, that's not the spirit of the game, that goal has been disallowed. Now, as you say, moving the line, you're going to say defenders saying, well, you know, that's not the spirit of defending. But I think the point is, we've got a trial. It's a pilot. Let's give it a go. Let's see how it works. And I mean, when I did the piece with David Ellery, I think it was back in December, that probably convinced, in hindsight, absolutely zero people that VAR was a good idea. but just made them even more angry about life. But I think it was mentioned in that piece by the head of IFAB. We've been told by other sports, NFL, etc., that it can take 10 years of tweaks to try and get a system like this sort of properly operational, to take 10 years to get glitches out, to tweak this rule, to tweak that rule. And this is all part of that. It was never going to be perfect. It was never going to be perfect, full stop, but it's going to take tweaks and pilots and changes as we go to get something we're happy with.
What I don't get is, were we that unhappy with the current offside rule before we had better technology to judge it by? I don't remember. I mean, look, there was the whole sort of daylight stuff. I remember those years. But the current offside rule as we have it, before we brought VAR and lines being drawn onto the pitch a couple of seasons ago, we weren't all saying that this offside rule was absolutely dreadful, were we? And there were always going to be tight calls, whether that was the margin of error or the assistant assistant referee flagging, or whether that was going to be the small margin of error that we see on a camera now. It makes I can't see how it makes any difference.
We're changing, so we're now changing the laws of the game to suit technology, to fit technology. That's the reality of it. And I don't think that's a good thing either. As you say, the offside rule, there's not... Look, it's not that you're kind of like scared of change necessarily, but that's, I think it's quite a dramatic intervention. I think it's, as Martin Ziegler wrote, and it's only the second change since in like 1925 in the offside law. And I don't think it's necessary. I think you either have better technology to decide what's offside and what isn't, or you kind of draw back a bit, as I've said before in this, on the use of the technology. I still think you could just get rid of the lines and look at the screen and go, look, that's offside or that's not, and do it quickly.
Doesn't it sort of sum up the climate in which this is all taking place, that the idea of a pilot is getting people alarmed and wound up? And, you know, this is not changed tomorrow. This is not even potentially going to happen. But someone has said, let's go and have a look what this does to the game. Will it be twice as many goals? Will it make, as Gregor says, will it suddenly make defenders think, you know, I'm, you know, dropping back 20 yards? It's, you know, we need to, and some people will say, and there's a decent case for saying some of these pilots maybe should have been done before VAR was introduced at all. But the fact, you know, we had to get to a point where it had to be sort of, you know, tried at the top level. But I think with this, you know, let's have a look. Let's see what the results are. I don't think there is any harm in that. I mean, that's what any sensible sport should do, isn't it?
Voice of reason. Matt, no place for it in this conversation.
I still don't know why the powers that be in football haven't listened to me yet. I still think there should be a sort of, you know, like an umpire's call, a margin of error where it's so close, a bit like Timo Werner's the other day, where basically the two lines for the defender and the attacker are drawn in such a close proximity that you just say, we can't tell, it's onside. You know, I just don't see why they haven't given themselves a third option. Maybe everything in football isn't black and white, Tom.
You're quite right. It's a reasonably sensible suggestion to you, which is why they've not considered it, obviously. There's a slightly worrying point here raised by Gregor in that I think he's right in that we are changing the law based on VAR and lines on a pitch. But VAR...
Potentially, that we'll see.
Potentially, quite right. Sorry, let's all get along. changing the law based on lines on a pitch, but lines on a pitch and VAR doesn't exist at every level of football. This is going to, if you've changed the offside law to this and then had this law existing in the game at levels where VAR doesn't exist, that is going to change the game. Unbelievable. If I am going to a game in League One and all of a sudden the striker has a greater margin of error, The assistant referee has got a completely different job on their hands. They have a difficult enough job as it is, and the standards aren't great. You see bad decisions made quite a lot, but that's fine. You know, we deal with it. It's a different level. It's a different pressure. But it's going to change the game completely. You're then going to get teams at the bottom of League Two scrapping for their lives, starting the game, and their back four is going to go no further than the edge of the box. Because what's the point in risking it? No, but seriously, what is the point in risking it? If you've not got a computer to back you up and go, you know what side there. Why are you going to push up to the halfway line? It's going to change the game completely. And I'm actually all for, you know, trialing new things. As Matt says, it's only a trial. Let's not get carried away. But there does seem to be an element of forgetting that VAR doesn't exist at every level of the game. And we talk about Super League and football splitting off and all these things. We're going to head into a position where Football League, you can keep the old offside rule, right? Premier League will have a new offside rule because you've got the technology, right? You guys can go and have a laugh and scream at the linesman. You can be old-fashioned traditional football. You guys can be new age VAR Wenger's law. It's fraught with danger, I would say.
Just on in my full role as a VAR nerd on this podcast, I think there have been a couple of leagues that have tried the margin of error thing, haven't they? I think they dared to risk the wrath of IFAB and FIFA. I think it was at Belgium, and anyway, they've tried. Where, you know, as you said to you, you draw the two lines, and if they're basically pretty much indistinguishable, then you know you end up having a margin for error. But that was sort of seen as going rogue. But it has been tried. It is out there as an idea, definitely.
At least Belgium listened to me anyway. Tom, do you think we will go from complaining about goals being disallowed that look onside, to the naked eye, that is, to them moaning about goals being allowed that look offside to the naked eye?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I'd say so. But as Gregor said at the start of this discussion, it's you're just moving the lines and moving the measurements of what you're talking about. It no longer it'll be trying to line up two different coloured lines on a pitch. It'll be looking at the space between two players on the system. I mean, I'm very, very continually conflicted about technology in football because, as I say, I have experience as a fan of watching a game that has no technology in it whatsoever. And you only need to have watched the highlights from the Football League this weekend to see matches like Middlesbrough's against Swansea's, where Middlesbrough were denied a clear goal because it was perceived that one of their players had fouled a Swansea player in the box when actually he just slid in, tapped the ball to a teammate who then smashed it into the top corner. Absolutely no bother. The Swansea player had done a little dive and the referee had said free kick. Then at the other end, there was a penalty given to Swansea in the same game. So you then had Neil Warnock, the king of moaning at referees and about referees, with all the ammo he needed to say, what more do we need to do? Why isn't this happening? And a colleague of mine who's a Middlesbrough fan said, I hate VAR, but this is why you need it. So it's so difficult. But I have hope and faith in someone as sensible and as knowledgeable as Matt Dickinson, the fact that he's still doubling down on his faith in VAR. And if we're going for it, if 10 years we'll got it right, then fine, maybe we should persist.
Yeah, no, if you want to know the breakfast conversation in my house this morning, it was my teenage boys, so one of them had read something about VAR in the Championship and said, if that happens, you know, I'm out, but my season ticket's going in the bin or whatever. So yeah, I'm losing the argument even at my own breakfast table. So don't worry.
Listen, it'll be interesting to see if he's got that same reaction if Queen's Park Rangers get promoted, and he's going to have to throw his season ticket in the bin because he'll have to use VAR. Then we'll see if he keeps that energy, as they say. Gregory, it's not just the offside rule, though, that we don't seem to have got a handle on at the moment. No puns intended, but handballs like this weekend. Handballs this weekend. Unbelievable. Arsenal, probably the victims of the biggest one. I mean, there's a huge inconsistency here. It's massive.
Yeah, although I was kind of found myself thinking last week when everyone was saying, well, all we want is consistency. I think, no, we don't, because it was an absolute nonsense at the start of the season. I don't want consistency with that. I want to find the best, you know, the best solution, the best decisions now. And, you know, everyone pointed to the Peters one. I was slightly conflicted about that. I know this is, a lot of people will probably say, what? But it was kind of similar to the Greenwood one, in that he wasn't, I know it's different in that he had more of an advantage by blocking the ball, but he was feeling for the player. Arteta was saying there was no attempt to move his hand out of the way. First of all, I don't think he had the time to do it. And secondly, it wasn't intentional. So I know that's not important by the laws, but I still think that's something that informs my view of that moment. I can see everyone probably doesn't agree with me here. But I think he was feeling for the man, and yes, Pepe would have been given. You know, he had an advantage. He was knocking the ball past him, so Peter's got an advantage. That should definitely come into consideration. But I still feel that at the heart of handball, you got to weigh up intent. You've got to weigh up how big the advantage was, and you've got to weigh up whether it's worthy of a penalty. Because as was said, all this has done this season has just made us realise that there is no such thing as a right and wrong answer with most of these.
I think that's an excellent point. And I just want to, again, in my role as voice of the Football League, broaden this out, because yeah, this is also a point that's going to, you know, it impacts and enrages fans across the country. But I wanted to ask Gregor, as a defender, then you're talking about these moments when you'd have been in the box jumping for a header. Alan Shearer always says you can't jump without your arms, feeling for a player to try and mark him. How often in your career did you either A, get penalised for a handball that you were like, what, ref, how the hell can I, or, you know, not necessarily for a penalty or just for anything, or did you actually find you probably got away with tapping it with your arm or your hand quite often and play would just continue. Because that's what I wonder, whether that's filtering into the game at the top level. We're having this scrutiny on these moments where normally play would have just carried on. Not a kind of hand up in the air, stopping a goal blatantly, but these little bounce up, hit you, let's just carry on, lads.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember ever being penalised for something like that. And I think that's the way it should have been. I think this is, we've gone in a different direction more recently. And
always ended up in the back of the net, Tom, that's why.
It's cruel, that's true. I just think that this is all ties into the same discussion about the kind of referees being on edge beforehand about what they should be given and following the protocols and the new law, and then there being a kind of change of heart and midway through the season, and now they're kind of, there's some that people have, because of what's going on, but in the first half of the season, they're looking at and going, this should be an penalty. You know, there's no consistency. Well, I don't want, as I say, you don't want consistency when the first half of the season was a farce. You want the right decisions to happen now. And I think they're closer to that than they were.
I'd agree with that. The Mario Lemina handball against Tottenham in Fulham's previous game before this weekend disallowed a goal because it dropped to Josh Maguire, who put it into the back of the net. I mean, that was one where you wanted the referee to have a look at the screen and say, well, no, I can't give a handball for that. But the rule is it hits an arm in the build-up to the goal, so it's handball. Whereas Lemina was literally, I mean, he couldn't have been stood more normally. It was like he was waiting at bus stop. His arm was right. It could have been in his pockets. You know, there's no way that you should be giving handball for that. But of course, the rules are, you know, it's in the build-up to a goal, it's handball. So strictly speaking, it was the correct call. But what I hate is, the next day they go, oh, actually, we'll change the rule on that because that was sort of ridiculous. And you're like, well, it didn't take much to break your rule book in half, did it? I mean, it's ridiculous. Matt?
But that was I agree with you. That, I mean, you look at that decision and that does not, again, you just got to, you got to think about, I mean, all that should underpin this really is an idea of what, you know, what feels right, what the game expects is the phrase, and that clearly did not feel right. I don't think it was just that incident that suddenly, you know, they had an agenda in which they were looking at a number of goals like that. It was just so happened that, you know, it would happen the night before the meeting. So it looks like a knee-jerk thing, but I think they'd realised that was a glitch in the rules for some time, to be honest, and a daft one.
I do think, though, and I've seen before, I think last season, Sheffield United headed it against Declan Rice's arm in the build-up to a goal for West Ham. And I did think that was handball just because his arms were slightly out, even though it was also unintentional and he couldn't do anything about it. Because I think there was absolutely no way he would have ended up with the ball if it hadn't have hit his arm. And I do think there still needs to be some kind of, you know, some kind of judgment in the middle of it. I just think when you look at Lamina's, you can say, okay, quite clearly, blasted at him. His arm was right beside his body, not in an unnatural position. A bit like the defenders at the other end of the pitch, you know. If your arms are right into your body and it hits your arm, it shouldn't be a penalty. If you've done something to make your body bigger or increase the size of the silhouette or whatever term they use, then I think fair enough. But I think that discretion still needs to be there to make that one a black and white rule was I think it was ridiculous from the start, personally.
Well, but that's, yeah. Again, they're straining, overstraining to try, you know, people say consistency. So then they overstrain to try and do black and white rules where they can say, okay, that, you know, you want consistency, here it is. And then again, we're moving the dial back to subjectivity, which in this instance, I think we're all agreed is a good thing. But what does subjectivity bring? It brings decisions that everyone, you know, for every 10 people who say that's the right decision, another 100 are going to say it's the wrong one. So, you know, it's just back to an acceptance that VAR is not about deciding those marginal discretionary decisions.
Matt, there are a lot of people that carve out a niche place in the media landscape. Supporting VAR has to be the nichest amongst them. That's a piece of genius on your behalf.
It's a lonely, very lonely place to be. I can tell you that. It's a, if you can't even sit in your own house and get support, then you know you're in trouble. I'm not sure there's anyone in Britain left. Is there? It's like I say, it goes back to, I've bored you before, sitting in a van in Holland feels 100 years ago. Seeing the first VAR experiment, thinking that's interesting, I'll write a piece about that, and then I've been stuck with it ever since, and it's like I can't get off the horse now.
Tom?
I was just going to say, on your point on Dicko sticking with it, he shouldn't be alone, really. He shouldn't be the only person in the country who supports VAR. Because let's be honest, technology in the game does rid us of really bad errors. But the point is that, as we've discussed, the minute way in which we pick over these Timo Werner-style offsides detracts from those moments in which watching something back on a video allows a referee to go, oh, God, yeah, I've had a shocker there, sorry, overturn the decision. That's great. That is a benefit to the game at the top level. At the very highest level, when all the millions and millions of pounds are involved and people's careers are on the line, correcting those decisions, it has to be said, is a good thing. But working within the media, we pore over these incidents like Timo Werner because they allow us to go, what on earth are you getting involved in our game for? And so the best bit to me of VAR and the recent rules is the idea of clear and obvious. And if that germ of an idea could be behind, yeah, but if it could be behind the idea, you know, as Hugh said, there's nothing about the Lamina handball that was clear and obvious. So it shouldn't be a part of a discussion. I'm just saying that it'd be great for not just for Matt Dickinson's career, but for the state of the game. If we were able to appreciate the moments in which VAR does good for the game, but at the minute the rules mean that we can't.
I just think that it will be forever VAR's biggest problem is that, as you say, correct. The best thing about it is its ability to correct the howlers. But once you have technology, everyone wants you to be able to correct and thinks, why can't we just correct the minute things as well? So, as Tom says, if you can find a way to get beyond that and stick, you know, return to the clear and obvious thing, then yeah, possibly there's a bit of a brighter future when we're not like tearing our hair out over this every week. But I just can't see it, because if there's a small error that can be corrected, then why would you not correct it? That's what everyone thinks.
Listen, I'm just glad that the game at the Etihad this weekend didn't come down to some sort of VAR decision from a Manchester United perspective, of course. Manchester United really did what they regularly seem to do to Manchester City under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, winning the derby, ending City's 21-game winning streak to boot. Gregor, let's talk about Manchester United's left-back, Luke Shaw, a position you played in, of course. He was man of the match. His game has certainly improved this season as well. Is he the best full-back around right now? Maybe bar João Cancelo at City.
He's the best English full-back and best English left-back, which is pretty remarkable when you think. Current form, I see a few faces being pulled there. Ben Chilwell is clearly a terrific player, but he's got a bit of a challenge on his hands now, and it looks like they're going to play with a back three and wing backs and Alonso's re-emergence. You know, as I say, 6 months ago that we would be saying that Shaw, and then you've got to remember, he's only 25. It's not like bringing him back is like bringing back an old dinosaur. He's still someone who very much can be a player of the future for England, which Southgate very much wants and looks for, and he's kind of always looking to the future. So yeah, his improvement has been remarkable, and not just defensively, but the way he's surging runs, his powerful runs with the ball at his feet through midfield, or, you know, he's got built up a really good relationship with Rashford. To see him kind of, as I say, surging forward, driving forward with the ball like that, like we did when he first broke onto the scene with Southampton, it's great, because there's always a kind of lingering feeling that after that, you know, horrific leg break, he wasn't quite the same. Maybe not quite the same turn of pace, and then his whole time with Jose Mourinho and his questioning of his kind of mental fortitude, essentially, you kind of feared for him, and to see him kind of blossom again with still 10 years of his career to go is brilliant for him and for Manchester United. So yeah, it was a superb goal and a brilliant throw from Henderson. And obviously Cancelo made an error in kind of overcommitting himself, but Shaw took advantage of it and brilliant finish.
The most roundabout way ever to say Andy Robertson's better than Luke Shaw I've ever heard, Gregor. Thanks for that.
Not in his current form. No, absolutely not. I was thinking very quickly, you know, you caught me on the hoof there. Trent Alexander-Arnold, I would say, is the best fullback. I can't think of any better in the world, really. But in current form, he's not. He's not in that patch.
I thought Greg would be saying Scotland have got two better left backs than England have got one, but
Kieran Tierney, obviously, yeah. I mean, yeah, okay, sorry, Tierney's better. Yeah.
I was about to say you've got to stay consistent. No, consistency is what we want on the podcast as well, not just in terms of our decisions, mate. Everyone Scottish is better than someone English. You've got to stick with it now. You've dug it. Go on. Go
Let's
on.
Let's go talk to McTominay now.
I would just like to say a quick word for Manchester United's other fullback on the other side, Aaron Wan-Bissaka, who. Very different player to Luke Shaw. But I was watching the game yesterday, and I think if there's one player who symbolises Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's Manchester United, it's Aaron Wan-Bissaka. Because incredibly solid, works very, very hard, good defensively, good recovery when in a bad position, very like Ole. Not very, very good against great players. He's excellent against Raheem Sterling. Raheem Sterling must hate playing against Aaron Wan-Bissaka. Pep Guardiola must hate playing against Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Wan-Bissaka's only thing he's got to improve on is just a bit more composure when he gets the chance in positions further up the pitch, which is a bit like Ole's Man United. When they get a chance, they just seem to bottle it. So I just thought that Aaron Wan-Bissaka seems to sum up Solskjaer's Man United, but he was absolutely brilliant yesterday.
It's box office when those two guys go at each other because they're so brave. Like, yeah. In both regards, so Wan-Bissaka, 90% of defenders, and I will class myself in this, absolutely no problem, take the easy option. If you can send a winger or a forward back, make them play backwards, you know, pressurise them, you've done your job. You think, that's it, I've done my job, get back in shape. Wan-Bissaka does that, but then he always goes to win the ball. And the amount of times you see him rob it when Sterling looks like he's already been pushed back and most people would be content with that, he's in on them. And the same is true for Sterling. When he gets the ball, despite all the kind of how good a defender Wan-Bissaka is, he'll keep going at him. So that's what made it so kind of such a box office kind of clash between them. And it always has been brilliant.
I wonder if the improvements that Luke Shaw has made was down to Alex Telles being brought in by Manchester United in the summer, that little bit of competition for his place. And I wonder if Manchester United bring in a right back who could credibly challenge Aaron Wan-Bissaka, whether that element to his game going forward could be improved as well, whether there is a little bit in Aaron Wan-Bissaka that knows he'll start every week at right back. It's been a problem area for Manchester United of late, aside from his signing, that is. But I just think the backup options aahrn't really there. They're linked with Norwich's Max Aarons, who I think would be a great addition. And maybe that could drive, particularly in the final third, some improvements to Wan-Bissaka as well, Tom.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think maybe push him on to the next level. Because as I say, I was obviously being slightly tongue-in-cheek saying he's symptomatic. I was being slightly tongue-in-cheek saying that he was symbolic of Solskjaer and his time at Manchester United. But he does need to improve that side of his game going forward. And when he gets into the opposition half in those positions, you know, on the corner of the penalty area, not just his delivery and his final ball, but his decision-making as well. That'll take him to that next elite level fullback, in which in the modern game is such a key position. But I would have just wondered on Wan-Bissaka, there's been talk recently about his international allegiance, to talk about him not playing for England and playing for Congo instead. I wondered whether on current form and with the Euros coming up, whether Gareth Southgate should be making a call. No, Gregor quite rightly picks out Trent as a superb talent, but he's not in the best of form this season. Anyone think he should be an England player?
I think personally, I think he's going to struggle to get in, to be honest. I think particularly with the wing-back system that Gareth looks set to use, I just think that obviously that puts even more onus on the attacking side of things. And I think when you see, as Ian Hawke has written this morning, Trippier's back back playing and looking in decent form. You've got Reece James, obviously. You've got Trent. I think Aaron Wan-Bissaka's fourth choice at best.
Tarek Lamptey.
I'd even have put James Justin before he did his ACL. Would it be?
Yeah, exactly. And in terms of the attacking side of it, Lamptey as well is up there. So particularly in the system that Gareth's got, I mean, you obviously, if you're Wan-Bissaka, you're not going to make an international judgment based on that sort of short-termism. But I think he's going to have to be extremely patient before he starts racking up England caps.
That demonstrates what the kind of priority is now for a fullback. Because he's probably the best defender, or one-on-one defender anyway, out of all of them. Perhaps positionally, you know, there's still the odd mistake here and there, but you'll learn that. But as I say, the fullback nowadays is almost more important what they do going forward than defensively.
Play him on the right of the back three, Gareth's favourite back three. We had Kyle Walker at the last World Cup as a fullback playing as a third centre back. Aaron Wan-Bissaka is that good defensively, you know, particularly one-on-one, great recovery pace. Play him on the right side. John Stones, Harry Maguire, is coming home. Can see it now.
Listen, it's not the worst idea in the world. Matt,
thanks,
do you think Luke Shaw?
Really
well, it's not the worst idea in the world. No, I mean, I can see what you're thinking. If I wanted to dissect Aaron Wan-Bissaka's game a little bit more, I'd say I'd still be worried about his marking in terms of that role as well. So that is the only thing. I just don't think he reads the area massively well as a fullback, and I just think, you know, as a back three, I'd be slightly worried about him anyway. On the other side, though, Matt Dickinson, the England squad coming up, not this week, probably next week or the week after. Luke Shaw, is he going to be brought back, do you think, by Gareth Southgate?
I think he will. I think you know, particularly, a manager wants to, you know, get the best players in, and he's up there. He's playing regularly, like we said. Chilwell's sort of, there's lots of chopping and changing at Chelsea, which is, you know, potentially making they're going to disrupt his time there. I mean, equally, if Chilwell can sort of make that position his own, playing a wing-back system could help him, you know, in terms of, you know, Southgate looking as a wing-back rather than a full-back. But no, I think Shaw has to be involved, because, and also, as an England manager, you have to reward form players. You have to reward guys who fight back. And as the guys have said before, I think that one of the really impressive things about Shaw is the way he's turned things around himself as well. I mean, I think, you know, yeah, he's been not just through form issues, injury issues. I think, you know, sort of being battered by Jose. I remember pictures of him, he almost sort of being ridiculed a bit when he was sort of holiday shots of him looking overweight as well. You know, he's been, you know, and some of this he's got to take responsibility for, obviously. But yeah, if a guy fights back, then that should be recognised.
Can we just briefly discuss that he's certainly, Twitter seems to tell me that he's 6'1".
Nonsense. Absolute nonsense.
It must be.
It's he was officially recorded somewhere, I think it might be Wikipedia, as 6'1", and people have picked up on this.
Yeah, it's going to have gone viral, isn't it?
I went to Carrington.
He can't be 6'1".
Yeah, I'm 6'1". I went to Carrington. I interviewed Luke Shaw. I can tell you now, first-hand experience, he is nowhere near as tall as me. Not even
you're
close.
You're taller than 6'1", though. Sorry to try and bust a hole in your theory, but I'm 6'3", and I've shared a lift with you, and you're nearly as tall as me. So maybe he is 6'1", and you're taller than you think you are.
Oh no, I'm like 6'1.5", man. I just maybe touching 6'2". Luke Shaw is like at least half a foot shorter than me. Like clearly nowhere near as tall as me. I mean, someone out there, it must be a typo, you know, because you can't go from 5'10" to 6'1". I don't know what's going on, but there is no way.
Shay Given was the other great one as well, because he always struck me as such a small goalkeeper. And then whenever I looked it up, which was several times during his career, they maintained that he was 6 foot at least. Some said 6'1". But you don't think Shay Given's that tall?
No, another player I've met, he's 6 foot, definitely.
He's correcting us on every single
Shay Given is definitely he's tall. He's someone that you would consider to be a tall guy. He's at least 6 foot tall.
Interesting. I'm enjoying this. Gregor, come to the game podcast. Gregor Robertson will give you all the details on what it was like as a player. Matt Dickinson will defend VAR, and Hugh Wasn't.
The problem for goalkeepers
who is not.
The problem for goalkeepers is if they play with massive centre halves, people go, they're not that tall, because you see them standing beside one another all the time. And if the goalkeeper is not towering over the defenders, people say he's not that big. So it very much depends on the players that you're playing with in terms of how you're perceived by the public. That's all I'm saying. Or who I interview, in which case you'll get an accurate view on how tall people are specifically. Just quickly before we end, Manchester United, obviously Manchester is red right now. We'll talk about them ending City's run. Of course, they did extend their own good run at the moment, though. They're up to 22 league games unbeaten away from home. And since it was a theme of runs, it got us thinking on ultimate runs, runs that teams have gone through, players have gone through, as odd as they might be. Tom Clark, why don't you get us started on this?
I'm going to get us started, not with one of my own, but our colleague James Restall sent on our group WhatsApp the best one I've heard, which was that his side, Leighton Orient, had the longest run without a player scoring 20 league goals in a season between 1978 and 2016, which I thought was the best niche run that anyone could come up with, which was fantastic. But mine is not necessarily a long run, but it's purely for how it ended. And it's in 2012 in the German league, FC Magdeburg. They'd gone five games without scoring a goal. You might remember this, but it was one of my favourite stories when I was breaking into journalism. I just started at a national newspaper, and I remember this coming out as a great picture story. They'd gone five games without scoring a goal. They were in pretty poor form. They were low down in the table. And this is kind of German third or fourth tier or something. So, you know, stadiums aren't packed out. And their fans came to a game with a banner which read, essentially, "Don't worry, lads, we'll show you where the goal is," which is quite funny enough. But then proceeded to a big group of them, around 50 of them, all got out giant arrows, all painted in different luminous colours, and walked around the stadium until they were stood behind the goal, pointing these arrows at the goal during the game. It was absolutely hilarious. If you haven't seen it, just look up FC Magdeburg 2012, and you'll find the clips and the pictures. It was fantastic. And then in brilliantly tragic fashion, they then scored in that game. They ended the goal drought in that game. Fans went mental, only to then lose the game 2-1 in the 89th minute. I mean, that's like, it's just, that is perfect football, bittersweet moment.
I'm probably going to have to reference Fort William here, who went 840 days and 73 games without a win. Until they won 5-2 against Nairn County in July 2019. That's Fort William, essentially, famed for being the worst team in the world. The worst team. Certainly the worst team in the UK. And, you know, not heard many worse than that. They're basically playing in a league that, the Scottish Highland League, that is too good for them. But there's no other football really to play in because they're so remote. And they've got to, like, travel to, they've got like eight hour round trips on kind of windy single track roads in a coach where everyone gets off the bus and feels sick every week. So it's a kind of recurring theme. And as I think I mentioned before, I went up there once and there was a torrential downpour and the game was cancelled. So that was a cracking trip for the journeyman. So yeah, Fort William. I also noticed in my, I was thinking the worst run I've ever been on. And you'll recognise that I'm saying worse rather than the best, because there weren't many great long runs. I think once in Forest, we went 17 games without a win, which is pretty bad. And it cost Paul Hart his job.
I have lovingly dusted down my copy of the Cambridge United, the league era, that's best-selling book. But I will take you back to 1983-84 when I was, well, I've been about 15-ish, and Cambridge United, my team, set a league record of 31 games without a win. We went from the beginning of October to the end of April without a league win. I saw an awful lot of those. God, it was miserable. But the great thing about non-winning runs is that when you win, as we did, it was the best day of my life, because not only did we win, we beat Newcastle United, who were about to go up. They had Kevin Keegan. I've got it all. Glenn Roeder, RIP. They had Peter Beardsley, Chris Waddle, Terry McDermott. And that was the end. It was a dodgy penalty, scuffed penalty, to beat them 1-0 after, 31 matches. And I can tell you, I've never been happier in my life. Don't tell my kids or my wife, but yeah, that was it. That was the peak. I can just add on to that. We set that record that year. And then the following year, we set a new record for most league defeats in a season. So, yeah.
Happy days.
and the following year, watching them, I used to have it in a notebook somewhere. I went to 19 matches and saw one victory in 19 matches. So there you go. But there's nothing like fan misery to really get you going.
Yeah, absolutely. It says an awful lot that this segment, introed it on the idea of Manchester City on being on a brilliant winning run. And we've all selected negative runs. From Germany to Scotland, down into the lower leagues of England, we've all selected losing runs. So, Hugh, are you going to end with a bit of positivity?
I'm just going to read Adams, who got in touch with us on social media. He says, Bradford City, this is a positive one. Most consecutive penalty shootout wins in the history of English football. 9 of them between October 2009 and December 2012. The run ended, he says, in the 15-16 season. I guess someone else must have broken the record. But there you go.
It had to be much more fun if it was penalty shootout defeats in a row. And, you know, I mean, you know, he's missed the spirit of it completely.
We should probably add, as Jeff Stelling used to always say, that they'll be dancing in the streets of TNS
yes.
this weekend.
Yes,
because TNS
right,
are, of course, the team who have the world record, 27, which was achieved in 2016. Beating the great Ajax team who had 26. So yes, TNS, I interviewed the manager who's since been dismissed actually. So a bit of a shame for Scott Ruscoe. But I interviewed them for a piece on Saturday and they were, let's just say they were very keen to keep hold of the record. So they'll be very pleased.
Absolutely. Special place in football history stays with the new Saints. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Matt Dickinson, Tom Clark and Gregor Robertson for being with me for the past hour or so. Been a pleasure as always. To those of you listening, thank you as well. Remember, if you enjoy the podcast, rate us, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. And make sure you're subscribed as well. You can get a digital subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times for more of our award-winning journalism on all of your devices. Sign up today. You'll get 1 month free. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame. There's Champions League football to come. We will see you on Thursday.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.